The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
President Michael D. Higgins, good morning.
Good morning, Brett.
And Uachtaráin, you're here. They let you out. Is it nice to be back out among the people?
Oh, very much so. I'm very much looking forward to, if you like, my full restoration to the people and getting around the country. Very, very much so. We've been doing things differently and we've got most of our work done, but I think, quite frankly, I've always got great energy from meeting people and from listening and hearing and knowing what is going on. I've been able to see people at some distance, maybe as I walk around the Auras across the moat and so on. But no, I very much look forward to it.
And on that, of you like to get out there and talk to people and see what's going on. Of the people you've been meeting in a limited way so far, what's your sense of the mood out there now? What are people saying to you?
Well, the first thing I would say is that I my heart has gone out, I have to say, to, I know, those people who are going to have their appointments rescheduled. The latest, the cyber attack, for example, that visited on top of having put up with, let us say, that the health services were affected by the response to COVID, essentially. That was inevitable. And we were just getting back to the point where people were looking forward to the normal meeting of appointments and that they could structure it in a different way. And then this appalling cyber attack happens, which is one that falls on the most vulnerable and on the most the most really dependent people. So therefore, that makes it a crime, really, of an extraordinary impact. And I think that they now must be suffering, I think, as a bit. But they'll get through it. You ask me what's my sense of it. My sense of it is that people have made a great fist of it and people genuinely want it to work. And I think we are going to get there now. I think that your personal forecasts about the weather are most encouraging.
But do you feel that we're in a time of more hope now?
Oh, yes, most definitely. And listening to you saying the change, for example, from 2 metres to 1 metre, there are so many sections of our population who have had it hard. Just think, for example, of those who have had small family businesses and they've tried to keep them going and they want to open up again. Think the people in the hospitality sector, of course. And they just want to be able to get back, if you like, to what was quite a precarious activity before before anything happened. So I want to wish them well. As far as I'm concerned, I have just got on with it. I think, for example, much of what I would have been doing before in meetings around the country, I must have made nearly 100 different virtual kind of addresses to different groups, with Samaritans, but in broad it would be the ILO and whatever. But that was that. And I had an advantage there as well, that I'm on in a place where there are grounds where I can walk and so on. And I have said before, my heart went out to all those who are, let us say, in tight circumstances. For example, if you were in a small flat or apartment and you had people that were dependent on you, that such people carried a great burden. I think it is important that we learn from what we have been through. It is told us a number of things. It told us the essential works that are most important and how they're often taken for granted. It tells us as well as that the different degrees of vulnerability that are there in the society. It tells us as well as, in a way, how we are so dependent on each other. The cyber attack makes that point very clear as well. And the importance of the public world.
Yeah, and you have a new book of some of your speeches around Europe. It's called Reclaiming the European Street. And actually, in the preface to it, you say that this is an opportunity to reflect that there is proof here that government is needed and can act decisively when the will is there. And I suspect, like many people of the left, you also think that there is an opportunity here for new thinking about our economics and our economic model and how we structure society.
When I think, first of all, any royalties due to me from this book will be going to Brother Kevin and the Caversham Book Centre, like my previous book, Bush. I think that it isn't only that there's an opportunity, there's a need. And I think running through the different, there are 23 chapters across five topics in that. They're really speeches that I gave between, over a period of about 5 years. And I think they're making the case for new thinking, and not just that there's an opportunity, but there is a need for a connection between ecological responsibility, which now I think there's a huge understanding of what has happened to the environment and nature, and we're putting our very planet itself in danger. The second is in relation, which I think the pandemic will have emphasised, is the huge differences in relation to participation in the society, levels of vulnerability, the absence of social justice. So I think the third then, I think, is in relation to the kind of economics which has been driven from a very narrow, that may be one of the points that runs right through my book, is that I've been in favour of of pluralist thinking. We should be able to engage with every model of managing the economy. So we're going to have to see a connection between ecology, issues of social justice and issues of economy. So I suppose what you're really speaking about, what I'm advocating in all of these speeches, is a form of social economy with ecological responsibility. And then I just don't speak about it. I actually address the new economists, people like Mariana Mazzucato, people like Ian Gough, Heat, Greed and Human Need, and economists like that. And I say the model is there. So what we have to do is we have to try and combine these three forms of consciousness in relation to nature and environment, in relation to social justice, and in relation to the new economics. And then I argue that will give us a better, not just a better Europe, but a better world.
It struck me, I don't mean to be mischievous here, but you were just telling me that you'd had two vaccines. And it struck me that would even you give credit to the animal spirits of capitalism and neoliberalism and everything for the extraordinary way that they mobilised, and within a year we had vaccines due to the much maligned Big Pharma?
Well, I think where you have to be very careful about this, and that is that it was a wonderful achievement of science and the application of technology. But what it also tells you is that the science and technology are promoted by the state through education and through research grants. They're promoted indeed through innovative and wonderful innovative companies. But the important thing is that it be there for the public benefit. We have to get to a point, if you're to deal with climate change, if you're to deal with sustainable economics, you have to have a concept of how interdependent we are, and there is such a thing as the global public commons. For example, you can't eliminate a pandemic globally without addressing it globally. So therefore, right where we were beginning, let us say with what we're now dealing with the cyber attack. Mm-hmm. In that, the case there is again, how are you going to deal with cybercrime if in fact you don't have a global approach towards dealing with such crime in a coordinated way? So the issue is, this is a debate that we haven't had. How is science and technology to be delivered for public benefit and at the same time create, be creative, be innovative, and so on? The idea that you would, let me be very clear, the idea that you would allow a global pharmacology companies to actually define the field is simply not on. We have paid an enormous price for poor regulation. What we now need as we move, be it in Ireland, be it in Europe, be it in the world, we need to redefine the forms of partnership between the state, the private sector and individual innovation.
And it sounds like you're arguing for a new type of globalism as well. People like you would often be accused of being against globalism, but that a new form of globalism, a partnership for good.
Well, you see, I suppose, Brendan, the position about it is that why I call my book Reclaiming the European Street, and this is the difference. I believe that there is nothing so complicated that citizens can't understand it if it is explained. And there's a huge difference between such a view and the idea that you have a very narrow group of people who are extraordinarily gifted and who are the only people who understand a financialised global economy and will, in the fullness of time before they die, get a spurge of philanthropy that will relieve their guilt.
Yeah, OK, I like it. Listen, that new consciousness you talk about, it strikes me that you have great faith in the young people, and you put out two lovely messages this week. One was to third level students during the week. Yes. And unlike many other people, President, you thanked them for their sacrifices and all this, because I was thinking they have been getting a hard time. Most recently in your spiritual home in Galway, we saw the crowds in Salt Hill, and students has become kind of a dirty word. But you think we should be thanking them?
Well, I think what... it's important that you seek to understand what they're thinking. I value my relationship with young people, and indeed with people of my own age, and it isn't difficult to be younger than me now. But what I was struck during COVID by something else is how little we know. We didn't know very much about how, what I call the social anthropology of age. We didn't know how older people would be able to respond to being locked in their houses. Mm. We didn't know very much about what would happen when friendship patterns that are usually negotiated through schools and through really different informal associations.
And what did we learn?
Well, what I thought was we learned about, this is what we did learn, this, is that we hadn't been listening to any, we didn't see much sociology in the response. We saw no social anthropology, by which I mean, how do people construct their days and nights and lives together? There was very little of that. And I think...
And what's your sense of it?
Well, my sense of it was very, very much, we have a lot to learn about language, the way we spoke about people, the way we, our capacity to listen. Also, I think as well, to be able to respect the complexity of things, you know. But what I do think, remember, there is a big, big, deep current that was running through it all. We're after about now, I'm 80, but we're over the last 40 years, we've had a clean run for individualism. This is not about just personal. The personal is very different. But the idea that you could, in fact, construct your life irrespective of others and irrespective of the consequences of your actions upon others, that's, I think, has delivered a very hard result. It meant that you have got... We lost social cohesion nearly every country in Europe.
Did we, though? Have we lost social cohesion?
Oh, yeah,
cohesion,
I think that's one
Ireland?
Of the things that we're...
God, I would have thought we've demonstrated ourselves as hugely socially cohesive over the last year. The way young GAA clubs mobilised to bring food to people, the way people looked after their neighbours, the way people looked out for each other.
Well, you see, that's all true, but you could put it another way. Is that we surprised ourselves at what we had still left about our care for other people. And it is certainly the case that we did. People played music outside other people's houses. People delivered groceries. People took care. But you know what it was, in a way? It was almost now, as you describe it, I find it interesting. It was almost, we did it despite what we had come to believe as the way that you should get on in the world.
Yeah, that think we dug deep to find that spirit of Mehel, that it was somewhere?
It was wonderful that it was still there. And what's even better is that it's still there to be built on. And I think that's maybe one of the great resources we have. And what's even better, I think, by comparison with some other countries as well, was the relationship between generations. Mm. You had older people expressing concern for the the children who weren't at school. You had the younger people expressing concern for older people. And so I know all that is very, very good, but there's much to be learned from it.
And so do you feel that's not reflected in our political system and in how we organise things on an official level in Ireland?
No, I think I like to be positive about it. I think it's time we debated what we should leave to the market and what we should have by way of general public provision. I think very, very strongly that what the kind of, if Europe is to succeed and be a model and be something that has something to offer to other parts of the world, it would be one way you would say there's a certain level of basic services that are there that enable you to live and to participate in the society. This was the thinking after the World Wars, for example. That's why you got the British National Health Service in its day. It's why you got public housing and so on. That people saw that having been through what they did, that they were now going to be able to live together, there were certain essential things you needed to do. I believe that, for example, that you can do that. I think you can provide universal basic services. You can ally it to forms of income. And I think that what that gives you, it gives you the largest number of people living in security from most of the great challenges in life. That's possible.
Okay, yes. Okay. And I'm mindful of your constitutional position, so we will not go into that in any more detail than you have gone into it, but people will take the gist of what you're saying.
Oh, they're almost sure to ring you, yes.
Listen, one of your big themes at the moment, I know, and there are some lovely speeches on it in the book as well, is remembering and what a tricky thing it is. And funnily enough, you gave a speech a couple of years ago about the Spanish flu pandemic and how it was essentially written out of history. And without getting into the various reasons for that, it did strike me, how should we remember what happened to us in the last year and a half? Because a lot of us are going to want to forget about it and move on in a way, and it's going to be different for everyone what their experience was. But it feels like we do need to think about how we will remember it, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, it does. And I think we should try and do so in as positive a way as possible. Rather than just endlessly blaming and recognising and blaming failures and different sections of the system that didn't work, I think we should try and move on. The misnamed Spanish flu, it wasn't, of course, the Spanish flu at all. It was really the Carolina flu, because the reason it became called the Spanish flu is because that was the only place you could recognise the flu. But my uncle died in that flu. My mother's youngest brother was 16 years of age, and he was a secondary school. And he went home to Liscarroll for a meeting, and he and another boy died in St. Coleman's in Fermoy. But there was a great silence following it. I think the reason for that possibly was so many young people had died in the war. The public attention was on the war rather than the flu. And then people didn't want to... people were worn down. It was 1918 was a terrible year. But how are we to deal with this one? I think the thing to do...
You say move on, which is interesting, that we do need to move on. But in a way, it's going to be harder for some people to move on, isn't it?
I think you'll find in the book that I regularly quote Hannah Arendt, and she suggests you deal with an event in the past in such a way as to remove its capacity from immobilizing you in the present or thinking about the future. Much of my own, when you interviewed Richard Carney, I think I used Carney's work and his introduction of Paul Ricoeur's work to very much in some of the speeches that are recorded in my book. But you have to. Otherwise, you become trapped. But how do you do that? And this is in relation to other issues that I'm dealing with through my Machnov seminars, is that you must recognise that you put as much emphasis as you can on what are uncontested fact and you have new research and history that will help you to do that. You leave that out. And then the other part is that the interpretation is different. There may be two different interpretations of a similar event. You allow for that. That's what Carney calls, I think, a hospitality of narratives.
Okay.
And then what I think the next part after that then is what I would say is that there is the structure that is put in this by people who are looking at it. And there isn't, you see, this is the where there isn't such a thing as, it wouldn't be a valid exercise to be looking for an official version or a homogeneous version. And there isn't really such a thing as collective memory either, because everybody brings to it all the influences that they have heard.
And so we can't actually ask the question, what happened there? We can't really get
well, we can say how much can we know about it, you can do.
Okay.
You can say how much can we know about it and what it is that we're disagreeing on. The great advantage of that is that you're transacting history. And just think of how important history is. The countries that are facing the greatest difficulties in the world are ones where they haven't thought history. You have to face history. And when I'm dealing with, let us say, which we can talk about again, is in relation to our Makhnov seminars or whatever.
Yeah, tell me about the Makhnov seminars.
Well, I think next Thursday we will broadcast number 3. And number 3 is on recovering imagined futures. I'm speaking about, for example, issues of land, social class, gender, and all of the violences. What was in the thinking of people? What had they drawn from the previous century, and what had they drawn from the circumstances they found themselves into as they moved into this period and what was going on? We'll be dealing with that. What we've had is that I decided, you know, I had been dealing in the previous presidency with issues of 1916 and so on, but what we're dealing with now, in December we held the first one where we looked at Rick Carney and people like that. I used his work, among others, and Ciarán Benson and others, to deal with what's involved in the act of commemoration. You make a selection. How did you select that from others? With what consequences, and how are you going to do it? And again, how will it, what is the purpose? The second one then we dealt with was about imperialism and nationalism, the response to it. What was happening in empires, and how were the nationalist struggles responding to it? And the third one, as I said, is now the one next Thursday. And then we'll publish a book then on the proceedings. They're all open to the public. My great hope is that for the next 3, number 4 then is on divisions and schisms, and Dermot Ferris and others will be speaking on that. But I'm hoping that the next, that may be with a full public audience, which I couldn't do during COVID. And then I'll run 2 next year on what were the influences on the states that emerged in Northern Ireland and here, and what influenced them. So there'll be 6 in all. So that's what the Makhnov seminars are about. Ethical remembering.
Excellent. And I believe RT are partnering you.
Yes,
you
indeed.
On that,
we've
and
support,
will be on the RT player.
Yes, we have support from the Commemoration Committee, and we have support for, and we deeply appreciate the support we're getting from RT and the fact that our work is on the RT player.
Uachtaráin, will you tell me about having chicken soup with Leonard Cohen? I'm imagining there could be a play in it. These two poets sitting down, both in the autumn of things.
Well, you're talking about both of our pasts now, of course. But it was in the gig here in Dublin and
after Kilmainham,
in Kilmainham, and what struck me about Leonard very, very much was the grace of the man. It was a very, very long set.
Yeah.
You know, he spent it just, and then there is the introduction of all of the musicians and the way that Leonard Cohen did it. And then because I'm wandering out, I see him there, and I just thanked him for the wonderful evening we had. And he asked me, would you like some soup? And I sat there and I had chicken soup with Leonard Cohen, yes. I'm a great admirer of that work.
What did you talk about?
What did we talk about? Yeah, that's interesting. We talked about the lyrics, actually.
Yeah.
We did, and I think maybe the one that I spent most time with Angelina leaving. Most of the discussion, to be quite frank with you, was about the way in which he had run the thing. Was the pacing. And about that, because that was very sophisticated. And yeah. I think we did, he did speak to me about his return to the tour.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There was a discussion about Buddhism. Yeah.
I should hope so. Speaking of Buddhism, are you still doing the yoga?
I am, but I'm an elapsed version.
Okay. I've taken it up myself recently.
Oh,
what
it's
I'm
wonderful.
Finding, it's great, but do I need to accept that I will never be great at it and just keep doing
it
anyway?
But it isn't a matter is that the person who knows so much more about all of these things is my wife, Sabina, who has been practicing yoga for most of her life and knows really about it. I think I have to take a great risk and misquote her and say what it is that the basics will stand to you.
Yeah.
It isn't about evaluating your performance, but, and certainly that is the case about the basic moves themselves. Remember, it's about gentleness, that it isn't about competition. And so you're not competing with anything, but.
So will you get back into it a bit more?
Oh, absolutely. The flow of the thing. Yes, indeed. And it will last you all your life.
Yeah, exactly.
And I wish, Sabina would say the same. Wouldn't it be wonderful if they were teaching it in schools and teaching it in institutions?
Absolutely.
And the great, wonderful, gentle, respectful way that it is of the human body.
I mean, I'm so sorry that I only found it at 50, and I presume you found it late.
But
late
I can see it's
well.
Having such wonderful effects already.
Am I glowing with enlightenment?
Oh, absolutely,
here?
With health, yes, indeed. Yeah.
And listen, you mentioned Sabina. I was talking to Henry Mountcharles a few weeks ago, and it sounds like him and his wife, Fiona, had an almost second honeymoon or a very special time in the last year. They were walking around the grounds and they talked about the past and everything. And it sounded like it was fantastic time for them, that people who had maybe not had time to catch up with each other properly, to look back over the times. Did you and Sabina have a nice time in the last year in a funny way?
Oh, we did. We had more time to think about things. May I first of all say I was delighted that Henry Mountcharles' health, that he's tackling it with such great courage. And I do wish him well. I remember very much meeting him and Iona and his son Alexander on occasion. And we have a mutual friend who is facing health challenges as well. And that's Eamon McCann. But I do wish him well. But no, we did have time. What I think maybe we had time to do quite a lot of reading. We had time to have more effort, maybe to have longer conversations between the events as well and think about it. But no, I keep emphasising what I was fortunate in what I had available to manage it.
Of course. And had you been unable to see family as well during that time? Because had a granddaughter, didn't you, at some stage?
We have our granddaughter, Fia. It was down in Wicklow, so we were relying on images, but we it was so wonderful that the two visits we had, but no, we missed that, and of course our other Alice May was working away separate from us and observing all the regulation as other people had, as we all had to do. So no, we managed, but we missed the family. Yes.
Yeah, you must be looking forward to travelling again too, are you? Will we ever travel with the abandon we travelled with before, the casual nature of how we took off here and there? And I know people say, oh, there's more to life than sun holidays, but people get so much out of travel and a change of scene and seeing other places, don't they?
I think it depends.
Really?
Aye.
Do you think it narrows the mind rather than broadens it?
No, not at all, no. I think, I think it's fascinating. I've thought about that. It's all right if, in fact, actually, it's satisfying some curiosity to some extent. But, you know, I can think of you know, you remember some places better than others, and for very obvious reasons.
But what do you think?
I certainly wish that all the people who are working in these sectors, that I hope they get going again, the rest of it. But frankly, you see, it's the difference. You see, I had a friend, he was in the council with me in Galway, Claude Toft. Toff's Amusements and so on.
Right.
But he used to always say, whenever he said to them, he would refuse to call himself a tourist. He used to call himself a traveller.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, there's a distinction between travelling and insatiable consumption of sun.
Yeah, and pina coladas.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Would that be your choice?
No, I would obviously, like all of us, I would like to think of myself as a traveller who lives like a local when I go to a place.
Full of curiosity.
Isn't that all our dream, that we get
full
have an
curiosity,
authentic experience when we go somewhere?
As they would say in the green tourism, you'd come with a whisper.
Yes. I like a bit of sun too, though, I have to say.
Oh, for the vitamin D, sure, we all need.
Absolutely. We absolutely need it. So it's a basic necessity. Listen, President Michael D. Higgins, it's wonderful to talk to you. Thank you very much. We'll take a break.
It's a pleasure.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.